Well, what a couple of weeks on this planet, huh? First of all, massive radiation out there in Japan, though they say it won't go much farther than 200 miles, maybe? Nah, it could go farther. Up next, Dr. J. Marvin Herndon joins us. We're going to talk about Maverick's Earth and universe. We're going to talk about the core. We're going to talk about the composition of the planet. And if any of this has anything to do with what's going on right now, we'll be back with Marvin Herndon in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, for the rest of tonight, we're going to talk about some real science and how these events on this planet might affect things that are happening right now. J. Marvin Herndon, scientist, strong and yet broad background, originally trained as a physicist. He earned his PhD in nuclear chemistry and received postdoctoral training in geochemistry and cosmochemistry from a world-class master of scientists who had themselves learned from other masters. Here's Dr. J. Marvin Herndon. Marvin, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, George. I'm very glad to be back.
What a time for you to be back. Oh my gosh.
I'm telling you, I just almost want to make a comment or two about Japan.
Please. Yeah, let's do that. I wanted to start with you on that and talk about this radiation fallout and its potential. But go ahead.
Well, let me tell you what the one thing that concerns me. You probably recall that back in World War II, Japan had a program to launch balloons, incendiary balloons,
mm-hmm.
that would drift over to the West Coast.
And a few of them made it.
And, yes, and fortunately, that was kept secret from Japan, and they thought the project was a failure. But that's the worrisome part. If there's a radiation release, it might make its way to the west coast of the United States, which is where we are, by the way.
That's right. We're right here.
So that's disconcerting. And I also wanted to comment on what I think this is really telling us. You know, there's something about nature that is a self-correcting effect in nature. For example, when a population of animals gets too large, something happens.
Yeah, they get culled out, don't they?
Yeah. And I think what this may be telling us is that nuclear reactors are too large. Now, I'm very much a proponent of nuclear power, but I think that the way to do it is with very small size. Now, there's a company
that take care of smaller regions, but if something happens to them, like in this particular case, it's not a worldwide calamity.
Exactly. Now, I'm familiar with one company that has designed a nuclear reactor that essentially would fit inside of a hot tub, and it would service about 20,000 homes.
Oh, my God.
And it would have to be refueled every 8 or 10 years. It would have a built-in mechanism. You can design reactors so that as they get hot, they shut down. This is designed that way. To me, this sounds like the future. Because even if there was a disaster with one of them, and it has a sealed core, it would only be a local disaster. But the Japanese have some of the smartest people around to design those reactors, and there were problems.
A problem, and they're calling us for help.
And there were problems in the design. And that's one of the difficulties when you get too large of a project. It becomes a certain amount of bureaucracy, and mistakes are made, and people don't know, and you get into trouble. And you can imagine a scenario where it could be a lot worse.
I was going to say, Marvin, in your opinion, what is the worst case scenario?
Well, the worst case scenario is if the containment vessels were to rupture, and the core were to run wild.
A complete meltdown?
Yes. Because then you have the problem of potentially an explosion and blowing out radioactive material.
Well, I was born in 1950, so I was born in the Korean War. other than what I read. I haven't been exposed to, nor do I truly understand the scope of fallout and radiation. I remember in the 60s in school.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we would have these little bomb shelter training programs where you'd have to, you know, sit with your knees, your head between your knees.
Yeah, get under your desk.
Get under your desk. And then people would build fallout shelters. I know growing up in the Dearborn Heights area in Michigan, our neighbor had his own fallout shelter. We all laughed at him. But I don't think people are laughing anymore. So in this particular case, what happens, Marvin, when people get exposed to too much radiation?
Oh, that's just nothing but bad news. It's nothing but bad news. Depends on how much radiation. I mean, you can get a little bit of radiation and end up...
Well, we get that from the sun every day, right?
Well, yes, but I mean a little more than a little bit, and end up feeling no particular ill effects until 5 or 10 years later you're coming down with leukemia.
And you have no idea why.
And you have no idea why. It's just all of a sudden that there's a larger population of people getting this. And it goes on to from that level up to really, really more severe. I'm hopeful that the Japanese circumstance won't get any worse than it is.
Why don't they just go in, take out all the rods, and put them away somewhere?
Well, it's not as simple as that.
Oh.
You have a very, very radioactive material. You can't get near it. Everything's done remotely. The control rods are inserted.
So even if you're in some heavy suit, it's still going to contaminate.
Oh, it's going to be hot stuff.
Oh.
I mean, it's really, really. I know in Chernobyl, the people that went in to do the work they did, a lot of those people got serious radiation problems.
Oh, God.
So I think the best we can hope for is that they're not more serious problems.
Marvin, will they be honest with us? These organizations that are monitoring the radiation levels, will they be honest with us? Will our government be honest with us? And will they say, all right, people on the West Coast, you're going to get hit with 1,000 times more radiation than we think you should. You need to leave. Will they be honest, or they just say, well, they're not going to die for 5 or 10 years, so let's not say anything?
Well, that sounds like the way it would probably be.
The second part, they won't tell us.
Yeah, because you know what the government does in the first place, it usually does it poorly, and in the second place, it usually obtains the opposite effect. And one thing that has become increasingly aware, and the politicians readily admit it, is they don't tell the truth, and that's a serious problem. No, I think that if there were a major radiation leak, they would try to cover it up.
Oh, that's upsetting.
But there are also a lot of intelligent people out there who would probably be able to detect it or find out about it.
And they know they have a voice on this program.
You took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say that.
No, go ahead. Say it again.
Okay. Well, you know that they would have a voice on your program.
Absolutely.
They would tell people. And so in that sense, we're living in a healthy time. But it could be a worrisome situation.
Oh, just have to monitor this thing every day.
I think so, but I really think the long-term solution is not to simply shut down reactors. I mean, you know how the politicians' reaction would be.
Yeah.
Well, let's kill nuclear power.
Instantly.
Yeah. Well, they've already killed drilling. You know, this is the drilling for oil.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of these absurd situations. We sit on one of the largest deposits of oil and natural gas in the world. And we have huge unemployment, and we have huge fuel prices. We're sending a lot of money to foreign countries for oil and gas. People that hate us. we're making them rich.
I have an Instapoll going right now. Let me read you the results.
Okay.
It's a pretty accurate poll, as a matter of fact. I would say it's plus or minus 5% based on my experience with polling. The question was, given the recent explosions at some of Japan's nuclear power plants after the tsunami, should America, one, close all nuclear plants and seek alternative forms of energy, two, halt the building of new plants, three, continue its current nuclear power policy without change? 29% of the people said close all nuclear plants and seek alternative forms of energy. 29%.
Okay, that's worrisome. Right.
24% said halt the building of new plants. So you've got a combination of 52% saying either close them all or halt the building of new ones. 46%, though, 47, say continue the current nuclear power policy without change. And I actually thought that was a high number.
Oh, I'm surprised, too. But you know what is not one of the questions, and of course, I don't blame because I'm just telling you about it. People don't know about this company that's that has, I think they already have an order from Poland or someplace for one, as I recall.
What's the name of the company?
It's Hyperion Power, Hyperion Power. Hyperion Power.
Right. We'll see if we can do an interview with those people.
I think it'd be a good idea. You might mention that that I brought it to your attention.
I will do that. I'll make sure we jump on that.
Because this is really, I mean, you know, if you don't have just two alternatives. I mean, the one alternative is huge power plants or no power plants. There is a third alternative, and it's these little self-contained plants that are designed and built to run and not go wild, to shut themselves down, and to service a small community. For example, you could have it a large hospital complex, or maybe 20,000 American type of homes, things like that. And yeah, you could have these all over the place.
Now, could you protect them so terrorists wouldn't grab the spent rods?
Well, allegedly, and I haven't looked at all the details, but allegedly these are. The coal core is sealed, and so it would not be an easy thing to. I think they are estimating a weight of something like 50 tons.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's not going to be something that a terrorist could easily steal.
You can't just walk, and then I'm sure there'd be alarms around it and everything else.
And right? but it's a. I think this is really the way to progress for the future. And yet you're not hearing about this.
No, not at all.
Well, yes, now you are. And you're hearing it on George Norrie's program.
Well, we're going to hear a lot on this program with you tonight, Marvin. Tell me about the magnetic pole shift. It's moving, they say, at about 40 miles an hour. What does this mean to us?
Okay, well, I need to give you a little bit of background.
All right.
In 1939, Walter Elsasser had the idea that the Earth's magnetic field is generated by a dynamo-like mechanism. See, a magnetic field requires the flow of electric charge. And he imagined that inside the Earth's core, there's heat at the bottom, produces a convection current. And these convection currents are twisted by the rotation of the planet into a configuration that they act like a magnetic amplifier, a dynamo. And this is really the only idea that surfaced that looks like it would do the job. And so this has been the idea that the Earth's magnetic field is produced by convection currents in the Earth's core. The Earth's core is almost a third of the mass of planet Earth. Now, There's always been a problem. What is the heat source? And I solved that problem when I realized that there would be uranium in the core. It would go to the center. It would act like a nuclear reactor. And so at first I thought, well, this is obviously the energy source for this dynamo action in the fluid core. Well, I got to looking into it a little bit deeper. It seems that this idea was so good that people never really questioned, can you have convection in the Earth's core? Now, convection, we've all seen it. You heat a pot of water on the stove, and before it starts to boil, you can notice the circulation, up, down bottom to top circulation. You put a few tea leaves in there, you can see that. Or you see a lava lamp. That's convection. The heat at the bottom makes the substance expand a little bit. It gets less dense, so it floats to the top, where it loses its heat, and it falls back down. Well, people just assumed that this could take place in the Earth's core. And I started looking at it, and whoa, this can't happen, and it can't happen for two reasons. One, for half convection, you have to keep the bottom hotter than the top.
Okay.
Well, the Earth's core is wrapped in a 2,000-mile thick blanket of silicate rock that has a much lower thermal conductivity, a lower heat capacity, and a much higher viscosity. In other words, it's a big insulator. So the heat that's brought to the top of the core cannot be efficiently removed. So you can't have convection going on for very long. There's another reason. The Earth's core is compressed by its own weight and by the weight of the rock above, so that the bottom of the Earth's core is something like 23% more dense than the top of the Earth's core. Well, heating can only decrease the density by less than 1%.
All right.
So you can't overcome that great density difference just by heating. You can't make matter less dense enough to float to the top of the core. Then there's still another mistake people have been making. Something called the Rayleigh number.
What's that?
It was calculated by Lord Rayleigh in 1916, and he was studying convection in a thin layer of fluid. And so he devised a dimensionless number, a formula that gives you a dimensionless number, that if it's a large number, it means you can have convection. Well, this has been applied over and over to the Earth's core as justification that, yes, you have convection. Well, I went back to the original 1916 paper that Lord Rayleigh wrote, and I realized that that derivation, that mathematical formula, was derived for an incompressible liquid. In other words, a liquid that the density was uniform, except where it was heated at the bottom. So it's not applicable to the Earth's core. So what all this means is that either Elsasser's idea is wrong, that the Earth's magnetic field is generated by some other mechanism, or there's another region.
And let's get that when we come back. Well, we'll take your phone calls next hour with Marvin Herndon as we talk about the magnetic pole and this planet in general. Hey, if you are a member of Streamlink, now it's called Coast Insiders, for just pennies a day, 25 cents a day, you can get downloads, podcasting, and just have some fun. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. Back to the core now, Marvin, and we don't mean the Marines, do we?
Not at all. That's at the center of the Earth.
Now, if this magnetic pole keeps changing, what's going to happen to us physically? Anything?
Well, let's can we step back and let me finish where I left off, because we're about to be able to explain this in a dramatic way.
Okay.
So the magnetic field can't be generated by a dynamo in the Earth's fluid core, which is a third of the planet. But it can be generated by convection within the georeactor, within the nuclear waste products shell that surrounds the nuclear core. And it can be maintained very stably because the heat that's produced by the nuclear core causes the convection in this radioactive waste fluid, and the heat is removed by contact with the Earth's inner core and with the Earth's core. So what this the real important element of this, that it gets down to what's happening now, is that the mass of the nuclear georeactor is so much less than the mass of the Earth's core. The mass of the georeactor is 1/10,000,000th the mass of the Earth's fluid core. Well, what that means is that it can be changed very, very quickly.
By?
By outside influences, for example. For example, because it's so small, changes in the stream of particles, charged particles from the sun, can induce currents.
Could man change it?
Not really. It may be a huge impact from a meteorite. But no, man can't, because we're talking about something that's a long way down.
Okay.
But because it's small, it can change very quickly. I mean, think about it this way. You can imagine that the direction and speed of a child's tiny self-moving toy train can be changed much more rapidly and with far less force than that of the longest and heaviest fully loaded full-size freight train. So what that then, that's a numerical comparison, by the way. And what this really means is that if the Earth's magnetic field is going to start changing, it can change very quickly. Now, there was a paper published in 1989 that indicated this is a paleomagnetic study of lava flows that indicated one episode of a very rapid reversal. This is times past during a magnetic reversal of 6 degrees per day.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. But the thing is that the whole geoscience community didn't know what to do with this. It didn't mean a whole lot. The interesting thing is that just this past year, that rapid reversal result's been confirmed by other researchers, finding another instance of rapid change. In this case, it's 1 degree per week, which is still a lot of change, because people had used to think that it was, you know, 3,000 years to do a reversal. So now you have two things. You have evidence from the past that a reversal can take place in a period of as short a time as a month or a year or some period like that. And you have an understanding of why that can happen, because the georeactor has such a small mass that it can change that quickly. I mean, if you were going to try to change the flow of the Earth's fluid core, if convection was possible and all this was happening the way people have thought 70 years, that just can't change quickly.
How do we know we have a fluid core?
Well, because they're basically two types of earthquake waves. One type is a compression wave, and that can go through a liquid or a solid. The other type is called a shear wave. It vibrates side to side, and it can go through a solid, but it can't go through a liquid, for the same reason that you can tear a piece of paper, but you can't tear water, a liquid. And so we know that the fluid core is fluid because the shear waves can't go through it.
Okay.
This is all known with a great deal of certainty. But what's not known, and this is the funny part, what is not known and hasn't been until just very recently in the last year or two that I discovered it, that convection is impossible in that big core. And so now you're looking at the geomagnetic field being generated by a much smaller unit, and a small unit can change quickly.
Are we approaching what we could call the perfect storm, in that we've got a magnetic reversals, an active sun, all these events happening on this planet right now, a full moon that is going to be closer than it's been in years? Is this all coming to a head?
I'm not going to say it is. However, you're seeing the indications. You're seeing that over the past 100 years, the intensity of the Earth's magnetic field has dropped considerably, half.
Something's not right, Marvin.
And the more rapid movement of the North Pole towards Siberia. You're right. I mean, that means there's something is changing. And I think that here's the worrisome part. No one's prepared for this.
No.
And if it changes, and it changes quickly, I mean, even if it's slow and it takes a year or a couple of years, I mean, my gosh, I mean, what's going to happen in the meantime?
I had a call Friday from someone in Tokyo, and this was before they were even aware of the scope of the damage. And I said, this is tantamount to an atomic bomb. And he said, nah, it's not that bad. Well, I got to tell you, you know, as we see these pictures every day now of this mass destruction, that's like an atomic bomb.
Oh, it is mass destruction. And if you actually calculate the numbers of a 9.1 or 8.9 earthquake, I mean, it's many atomic bombs worth.
It's moved Japan closer to us.
Yeah.
Physically.
Oh, you see I think a lot of the news media focus on the nuclear reactor problems. But if you look at the problems of the humanity, I mean, it is devastating. I think there'll be many, many thousands of deaths.
Just from people who can't eat, drink, get shelter.
Oh, and I'm telling you, when that big wave comes, I mean, you know, nothing's going to stop.
No, do they drown? Do they get crushed because of the weight and the force of the wave?
Oh, I'm sure you would get crushed. I mean, I've been swimming on the East Coast when a big wave would come in, and I mean, not a tsunami wave, just a strong wave. And be knocked down and battered on the shells at the bottom,
or pulled out toward the ocean.
No, this can be terrible. And you see houses and cars and all sorts of things. It'd be easy to be crushed on those things.
Yeah, I mean, I've never witnessed anything like this before.
Oh, no, that's terrible. And so, I mean, that is a true tragedy.
You know, what's amazing, Indonesia, almost 300,000 lives wiped out from that tsunami. Yeah. This one I don't think will go that high. But if the radiation is bad,
oh, that's going to be the serious.
It could dwarf those numbers in Indonesia.
That's going to be serious. I just hope that the radiation doesn't get any worse than it is.
Now, when people talk about a pole shift, are they talking about a planet that flips upside down?
Well, we're only talking about the magnetic.
The magnetic. But can there be a physical flip as well?
No, the flip would really occur in the fluid that is convecting, and that would be in this nuclear georeactor, a mass that's about 5 or maybe 10 miles in diameter. So you're talking about flipping on a small scale, but you're also talking about the Earth's magnetic field essentially shutting down and hopefully restarting. I say hopefully because, you know, there's going to be some point when the Earth's magnetic field shuts down and doesn't restart. That's when the fuel runs out in the nuclear georeactor.
And that's when you have a dead planet.
And that is when you have a planet like Mars, for example.
Yeah.
So that's a concern. And what makes it really bad with a potential for a reversal, and because a reversal, more or less, the field goes to zero or close to that before it turns around or comes back up. The Earth's magnetic field is the shield. It's Earth's shield. You know, the solar wind is from the sun just bombards us, and the charged particles are deflected by the Earth's magnetic field, deflected around and past the planet.
Marvin, next week it's supposed to be spring. We're supposed to hear birds chirp. The weather gets nice. It's supposed to be pleasant. Are we going to lose all of that?
Well, if at some point we're going to be in a very strange world. I mean, let me, and what makes it really difficult is that we are a technologically dependent civilization.
Yes.
So
More
now than ever. So when the geomagnetic field collapses, what'll happen is vast segments of the population will be without electricity. The electrical power grids will act like uncontrolled generators as the charged particle flux of the rampaging solar wind sweeps past.
For how long?
Well, for as long as it's happening, inducing into their lines suicidal bursts of electrical currents that can short-circuit and damage essential elements of the power grid.
Could they blow up your refrigerator?
Maybe cause it not to work.
Yeah.
This is known because sometimes the storms on the sun give a little more intense than usual solar wind, and this has happened, that it sort of overwhelms the Earth's magnetic field, and it has induced currents and power grids that have taken out transformers and the like. But there's more, because the electrical currents can be induced in any long conductor, like gas lines and oil pipelines, causing explosions and fires. And charges will build up on surfaces and reach staggeringly high potentials at edges and sharp points, posing risks of electrocution and ignition of fire.
Jeez.
Satellites will no longer function.
They'll be gone. ATMs won't work.
Yeah,
their
electronics will be fried, and they'll be the early casualties. There'll be widespread failure of communication and navigation systems.
What will people do without an internet, without cell phones?
Oh, we'd be in trouble.
I mean, no social communications anymore.
Oh, we would be in trouble. And so much of the communications for controlling industries and power plants and sewage treatment plants and so forth are, you know, a lot of these things are connected through the internet, the banking system, for example. So I know we would be in serious trouble, and that's just not the worst of it. What we don't know is the serious long-term effects. I mean, it's got to be an adverse effect. It's got to be bad, and it's got to be severe. We just don't know what it is. And those are just the things that we have some idea about. I mean, you can imagine things that might happen. For example, would these charged particles cause cloud formation throughout our planet? Maybe have the makings of an ice age happening? I mean, these are speculations. We don't know what'll happen, but it's got to be bad.
Well, you know, they say these are the best of times, these are the worst of times.
Yes, that's Charles Dickens was absolutely right about that. And so we don't know, but the thing is that what we should be doing is to be preparing and not blindly believing that, well, it's the Earth's core isn't going to change quickly and things like that. Because there are people who are very bright who could be thinking of these things. And engineering solutions. And that's one of the possibilities we should be looking at.
Yeah. Well, are you glad you're here on the planet right now?
Well, I am indeed glad, and I'm especially glad I'm here on your show. This is always fun, George.
I know it. We'll get some calls next hour in and everything else.
Before we do, when we have a few minutes, I want to tell you a wonderful story.
Okay. Now, we're going to hit the top of the hour pretty soon, but let's start. Go ahead.
Okay. I don't know. I'm sure that people in your audience know the name Lynn Margulis.
Of course.
Well, she, by the way, there's a really grand interview with her in the April issue of Discover Magazine. Some people will know her as being, having a kind of genius that far exceeds Charles Darwin's. She's seen a different path for evolution. Well, I won't get into that. Others will remember that she was married to Carl Sagan.
That's right.
Well, here's the nice story. She got interested in my work, and she decided to offer something. She offered to edit a paper in which I describe what I've done. Well, I learned to write very, very well from the masters. And in some 30 years, editors of journals and books have never been able to do much with my work. Oh, well, a little bit here, a little bit there, but basically, it's been more or less untouchable. Well, that was before Lynn. She decided, she asked me to write a draft, and I did, and she started to edit it. And she'd only do a little piece at a time and insisted that she understand it, and it was written so that other people could understand it. Well, my God, I've never seen anything like this. I mean, this went through something like 23 major revisions.
23?
Oh, I've never seen anything like it.
I'd be frustrated by then, I'll tell you.
She would take one of my typed versions and send it by express mail, all marked up.
You got to tell us the rest of the story when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.